You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support.
Welcome. This is The New Yorker, and I'm your reader, Dale. Today, I'll be reading from the November 24th issue, copyright 2025, Condé Nast. On the cover this week, a painting of a storefront. The storefront is made entirely of pane glass windows with a recessed front door. The entryway forms a shallow alcove with glass panels on both sides framing the dark wooden door. A few small rectangles of colored paper are affixed to the door's glass like notices or business hours, though none are legible. Three light fixtures overhang the front door and cast a downward glow in the alcove, but the rest of the scene outside is dimly lit. Through the windows, blurry soft shapes, suggesting tables and displays, are visible, and lamps cast a soft glow, but nothing is distinct. Outside, on the right-hand side of the alcove, a man in a blue business suit and black dress shoes sits, facing to our left, on the end of a bench. He rests his chin on his hand with his elbow resting on his leg. The scene is geometrically precise and orderly, but with no human activity other than the man on the bench. The dim lighting and lack of activity in the store imply that it is early morning before the store opens. The illustration is titled Early Morning and is by Kenton Nelson. The New Yorker Online provides this commentary on the image, written by Francois Mouly. For the cover of the November 24, 2025 issue, the artist Kenton Nelson painted a man waiting by a store window. Walking through the city one early morning, looking for paintings, I was attracted to the mysterious interior light of a store, Nelson said. It was quiet, and I was alone. I set a timer on my phone and took a photo of myself as the figure. Our next article is from The Talk of the Town. Comment, begging your pardon. A presidential pardon, like sainthood, must be assiduously pursued in order to be obtained but not openly desired. Last Monday, when Rudy Giuliani received a remarkably broad pardon from Donald Trump, a spokesperson for the former mayor said that his client had never sought a pardon but is deeply grateful for President Trump's decision. Giuliani's pardon was among more than 70 issued in a batch, many of them blanket prophylactic measures for Trump's allies in the effort to overturn the 2020 election, including the former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and the lawyers John Eastman and Sidney Powell, none of whom face federal charges. On the same day, the White House announced that Trump had pardoned dozens of other people, including a congresswoman's pharmacist husband who distributed a dialysis drug from China that had not been approved by the FDA, an ultra-runner who took a quick detour on a protected Grand Teton Trail, and the former Met star Daryl Strawberry for his conviction on a tax evasion charge. That list had some of the feeling of the bestowal of the King's Birthday honors, except that nearly everyone on it had been charged with a federal crime. Histories of the pardon power tend to begin with Hammurabi and flow through the centuries. James II once sold a reprieve for £16,000, and it is a rare feature of monarchical power which the founders adopted in the Constitution. A modern case for the measure, articulated by the Oxford philosopher Adam Perry, is that when laws are broadly fair but unfair in a particular instance, pardons allow for selective deviation. Sometimes the pardon power has been used as a corrective when the social consensus behind a particular law has changed, but sentences endure. Jimmy Carter pardoned Vietnam War draft dodgers, and Joe Biden cleared the names of several thousand Americans convicted of federal marijuana crimes. Yet entrusting a president to select when to deviate from the law tends to lead to a friends and family approach, as when Bill Clinton pardoned the billionaire Mark Rich, who had fled the country before facing charges, or when Biden exempted his son Hunter from charges brought by his own Department of Justice. Pardons can become a shortcut to a separate system of justice. But Trump, in his second term, has begun to expand the pardon power both in nature and in scale. This spring, he fired Liz Oyer, a career official in charge of the pardon office, after she refused to recommend reinstating gun ownership rights to Mel Gibson. Trump then appointed a keen loyalist, Ed Martin, to lead the office. A kind of pardon economy has bloomed. In May, the Wall Street Journal reported that pardon seekers were shelling out to hire lawyers and lobbyists who tout access to those in the president's inner circle. In March, Trump pardoned an electric truck entrepreneur named Trevor Milton, who was convicted on fraud charges. The president said that Milton had been highly recommended to him by top-of-the-line people. Milton had also contributed to Trump's and Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s campaigns. "No MAGA left behind," Martin tweeted. "He seems to mean it. Trump granted 238 pardons and commutations in his first term. Less than a year into his second, he has issued nearly 2,000. In most cases, of course, the person being pardoned had been found guilty of a crime. The pardon economy presents the possibility that if you're nice enough to the president, a jury's judgment might be set aside. But you have to stay nice. On Newsmax, Trump mused about a potential pardon for Diddy on his conviction for prostitution-related charges. "I got along with him great," the president said, "but when I ran for office, he was very hostile." He added, "I'm being honest, it makes it more difficult to do." Many of Trump's pardons have helped him secure political loyalties. He has pardoned more than 1,000 people convicted on charges related to the events of January 6th, as well as dozens of fake electors and lawyers who supported those events. But some of the most egregious acts contain a financial element. Last month, Trump pardoned the Chinese-Canadian billionaire Changpeng Zhao, who founded the crypto exchange Binance. In 2023, Zhao pleaded guilty to failing to report the use of the platform by terrorist entities and individuals sanctioned by the U.S. government. This spring, according to the journal, Binance took steps that boosted the value of a stable coin developed by World Liberty Financial, in which the Trump family has a large stake, including the receipt of a $2 billion investment. Representatives for both World Liberty Financial and Binance denied that there was any impropriety. When asked on 60 Minutes about Zhao's pardon, Trump said, "Okay, are you ready? I don't know who he is." The ingenuity of Trump's initiative is that it is explicitly permitted by the Constitution, which states that the president shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States. But the power can still be politically entangling. The White House press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, has generally argued that Trump's pardons are correcting overzealous prosecutions by the Biden administration of political enemies and financial upstarts, in effect claiming that the social consensus has shifted to the right. But Trump's popularity has declined. It's 41% in the Times polling average, and this month's elections went badly for the GOP, so the correcting Biden justification may have less traction. That could prove particularly true with Trump's stickiest problem, which he's been lately calling the Epstein hoax. Over the summer, after Justice Department officials had promised to review investigative files on the activities of the late financier Jeffrey Epstein, the Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche met with Ghislaine Maxwell, who was serving a 20-year sentence for conspiring with Epstein to sexually exploit and abuse minors. She told Blanche that Trump had always been a gentleman and that she'd never seen him in Epstein's house or in any type of massage setting. She was then moved to a minimum security prison where she is reportedly preparing an application for commutation, but last week House Democrats released thousands of documents obtained from Epstein's estate, including some emails that appeared to contradict her. Last week, the White House said that Trump is not considering a pardon for Maxwell. And no wonder. If he were to issue one, it would highlight in a very public way the system that he and his subordinates have built, a separate tier of justice for his allies and investors, a legal gray zone for people the president finds useful. And that article was written by Benjamin Wallace Wells. Our next article is from Profiles, and it's titled Wild at Heart, Stephen Fry's Lifelong Bond with the Wittiest and the Most Tortured of Writers. And this article was written by Rebecca Mead. When The Importance of Being Earnest by Oscar Wilde opened on February 14, 1895 in London, the date was well chosen. It was the Victorians, after all, who decisively turned the Feast of St. Valentine into a mass commercial celebration with would-be lovers concealing their identities behind an anonymous exchange of greeting cards and other tokens of desire. Ernest, the fourth drawing-room comedy that Wilde had produced within 3 years, centered on the courtship of two young women, Gwendolyn Fairfax and Cecily Cardew, by two young men, Jack Worthing and Algernon Moncrief. Both suitors repeatedly resort to subterfuge in order to maintain double lives in which the satisfactions of social respectability are counterbalanced by the pursuit of pleasure and personal freedom. The play, which Wilde gave a paradoxical subtitle, A Trivial Comedy for Serious People, harnessed Shakespearean conventions of mistaken identity and romantic disguise. At different moments, each man pretends to be named Ernest. The skittering plot is anchored by Lady Bracknell, the mother of Gwendolyn, and the aunt of Algernon, an overbearing elder who often thwarts the lover's intentions. She is the voice of Victorian probity in Wilde's deranged scenario. This canonical part has been played by some of the foremost women of the British stage, among them Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, and Edith Evans, who, in Anthony Asquith's 1952 film adaptation, put a delightfully querulous spin on Lady Bracknell's most indelible lines. To lose one parent, Mr. Worthing, may be regarded as a misfortune. To lose both looks like carelessness. Late this summer, it was announced that the role would be tackled in a new West End production by another well-known British performer, Stephen Fry. The actor, comic, novelist, memoirist, radio presenter, television personality, gay rights advocate, mental health campaigner, and, as of earlier this year, Knight Bachelor. Now 68, Fry has been a household name in Britain for 4 decades, though it might be more accurate to call him a household voice, his resident baritone being instantly recognizable everywhere from Harry Potter audiobooks to commercials for Sainsbury's supermarkets. When this fall he appeared in a celebrity version of the hit reality show The Traitors, his fellow participants referred to him earnestly as National Treasure Stephen Fry. In early September, the cast of Ernest was in the production's rehearsal space on Gray's Inn Road in central London, practicing a scene in which Lady Bracknell directs a flurry of questions to Jack, or Ernest, the false name he uses in town. A twitchily silly Nathan Stewart Jarrett playing Jack stood stage left, while Fry sat stage right, a tea table at his elbow. Fry was dressed in black jeans and a fleece top, and he had at his waist a small bag that was standing in for Lady Bracknell's reticule. Taking a notebook out of it, Fry delivered his lines. I feel bound to tell you that you were not down on my list of eligible young men, although I have the same list as the dear Duchess of Bolton has. We work together, in fact. Lady Bracknell scans a checklist. Does Jack smoke? He does. I am glad to hear it. A man should always have an occupation of some kind. The Inquisition is an exercise in absurdity grounded in the very rational, if unspoken, imperative that Gwendolyn should marry wealth. After delivering one of Lady Bracknell's more ridiculous apothegms, I have always been of opinion that a man who desires to get married should know either everything or nothing. Which do you know? Fry glowed with satisfaction when Stuart Jarrett responded, I know nothing. Fry, in a register pitched only slightly higher than his natural speaking voice, said, I am pleased to hear it. I do not approve of anything that tampers with natural ignorance. Ignorance is like a delicate, exotic fruit. Touch it, and the bloom is gone. Lady Bracknell's approval turns to horror, however, when she learns that Jack was a foundling who was abandoned in a train station in a carryall. The focus of her horror? A handbag? After this one-liner, Fry expertly unfurled one of the character's more sidewinding sentences, with which Wilde parodied the verbosity as well as the morality of his age. To be born, or at any rate bred, in a handbag, whether it had handles or not, seems to me to display a contempt for the ordinary decencies of family life that reminds one of the worst excesses of the French Revolution. During a break, Fry told me, if that scene doesn't get them going, you really have failed. We were walking to have lunch nearby on Lamb's Conduit Street. Fry is 6'4" with a swift stride, and he traversed the streets as fluently as he had the language of Ernest. During the run-through, Fry had delivered the handbag ejaculation in a tremulous tone of disbelief, and I asked if he'd settled on that as his approach. The trouble is, it's a bit of a to-be-or-not-to-be moment, he observed, meaning that the line is one of the play's most famous. It varies every time I do it, and I think it should, for the moment at least. It tends to concretize it later in the run. It's a wanky, actory thing to say. His voice grew plumier, finding the verity in exaggeration. But you have to play the truth of the scene. In this production of Ernest, which opened to acclaim in the West End in late September, the sexual energy between the four young people isn't confined to the ostensible heterosexual couplings of the text. Gwendolyn and Cecily pant for each other. Algernon and Jack's friendship is shaded with flirtation. This is a choice that seeks to make explicit a truth of the play, that Wilde's confection about doubling and disguise is itself a doubled, disguised work. In Ernest, Wilde all but exposed his secret homosexual life, at least for those who had the ears to hear it. The Duchess of Bolton, for example, would have sounded to much of Wilde's audience like the name of a generic aristocrat. But for Wilde's coterie of gay friends, the name surely brought to mind a Victorian precursor, Ernest Bolton, who, along with a companion, Frederick Park, had been arrested in London while wearing women's clothing. They call themselves Stella and Fanny, respectively, and they were charged with the abominable crime of buggery. In a triumphant twist, both were acquitted. Of course, it's all brilliantly deniable, Max Webster, the production's director, told me. He cited Jack as Ernest's exclamation to Algernon of his feelings about Gwendolyn. She is the only girl I ever saw in my life that I would marry, Webster explained. It's all about the stress. You can say the only girl I would ever marry, but if you say the only girl I would ever marry, it's clearly gay. The whole thing has deniability, which on the one hand is a way of saving yourself, if that's the level of risk in talking about your sexuality in public. But it also reflects Wilde's belief, which is why he's a proto-modernist, that meaning is various, that the self is constructed, that identity is a bubble that is constantly shimmering and transforming. The first reviewers of Wilde's Valentine's Day offering recognized that his play subverted some of the era's social conventions. One noted, the most common sense actions of daily life take place with the one important difference that the common sense has been left out. You have fallen among amiable, gay, and witty lunatics. Wilde himself called the play a delicate bubble of fancy, as Fry reminded me over lunch, adding that in an 1895 interview, Wilde had described the play's undergirding philosophy. We should treat all the trivial things of life very seriously, and all the serious things of life with sincere and studied triviality. He was a pervert. He inverted everything, Fry said. Invert was the word they used for a queer man at the time. It is the essence of what he teaches us by reversing everything Victorian and making it funny. But also as true in its reverse, it exposes its valuelessness. Wilde's triumph with Ernest was followed almost immediately by his downfall. Days after opening night, the Marquess of Queensberry, incensed by Wilde's close companionship with his son, Lord Alfred Douglas, sent to Wilde's social club a kind of counter-Valentine, a card onto which he'd scrawled the ungrammatical accusation that the playwright was a posing sodomite. This triggered a series of court cases for Wilde that culminated in a conviction of gross indecency and a sentence of 2 years of hard labor in prison in Reading Gaol. His name was removed from the playbills at the theaters where his shows were running. Soon thereafter, the plays themselves closed. By the time he died, he contracted meningitis in 1900 in Paris at the age of 46. His reputation had burst like a bubble. At lunch, Fry took his phone out of his pocket and opened a document containing the final paragraph of Richard Ellman's acclaimed biography of Wilde from 1987. "I always carry it with me," Fry said, then read aloud. "We inherit his struggle to achieve supreme fictions in art, to associate art with social change, to bring together individual and social impulse, to save what is eccentric and singular from being sanitized and standardized, to replace a morality of severity by one of sympathy. He belongs to our world more than to Victoria's. Now, beyond the reach of scandal, his best writings validated by time, he comes before us still, a towering figure laughing and weeping, with parables and paradoxes so generous, so amusing, and so right." Fry looked up, eyes glistening. "Isn't that stunning? What a way to end a biography. I'd like to think that Wilde had a belief that his best writings, as Ellman puts it, would be validated by time, and that his reputation would be salvaged to some extent amongst the literary. But," he added, "not even Wilde could have imagined that a glass barrier would eventually need to be erected around his tomb at Pierre Lachaise Cemetery in Paris to protect it from the ocular adoration of pilgrims." Fry noted the limestone had been corroded by so many kisses and stained red by lipstick. "It makes me crack up even now," he went on. "It's such a wonderful vindication." Fry's incarnation of Wilde's most recognizable stage creation feels all but inevitable. His personal and professional affinity with the writer is of long standing. He is far from the first male actor to take on Lady Bracknell. David Suchet, Brian Bedford, and Quentin Crisp have all portrayed the role. In 1993, Fry was cast as Wilde himself in an episode of the TV miniseries Ned Blessing, and at the time he told an interviewer that the part was one he'd been born to play. 4 years later, he was born again as Wilde in a biopic based on Ellman's biography and directed by Brian Gilbert. Fry shone as the tragic Wilde, done in by his love for Douglas, played by a cruel and golden Jude Law. Overall, though, the film was more ponderous than its subject had ever allowed himself to be. Wildean is an easy epithet to bestow on a brilliant and charismatic gay man, particularly one who delights in confounding social pieties and confusing the literal-minded. But Fry earns the adjective. If Wilde became infamous after the public exposure of his homosexuality, Fry, who publicly acknowledged his own homosexuality for the first time in 1988, gained notoriety for writing about his celibacy in 1985, at a moment when the sexual revolution had supposedly liberated all erotic desires. He made the scandalizing avowal in an essay for the magazine Tatler, expressing distaste for the damp, dark, foul-smelling, and revoltingly tufted areas of the human body that constitute the main dishes in the banquet of human love. By then, to have sex with one's own gender may have been regarded as unexceptional. To have no sex at all looked like contrariness. The cultural twinning of Fry and Wilde draws some strength, too, from their similar physical appearance. Like Fry, Wilde was tall. Like Wilde, Fry has fluctuated in weight, though these days he's on the trim side. Both men's physiognomy can lean similarly to the lugubrious. Fry recounted that at a restaurant in Covent Garden, I went to the loo and I was washing my hands, and in the mirror behind me was Alan Bennett, the British author of The Madness of George III, among other plays, and he said, I was looking across the room and I thought, he looks like Oscar Wilde. Fry's imitation of Bennett's Yorkshire accent was impeccable. I looked at myself, and I did have a center parting, and I was getting a bit fleshier, and I thought, I suppose I do look a bit like him. Fry's biography has invited irresistible comparison to Wilde's, and the actor shares the author's high-life, low-life credentials. Both became pals with their eras, Princes of Wales. Wilde got to know the future King Edward VII, who asked a mutual friend for an introduction, saying, I do not know Mr. Wilde, and not to know Mr. Wilde is not to be known. Fry met the future King Charles III in the late 80s at an official event and recalls the prince remarking that they were neighbors in Norfolk. Charles soon invited himself and his then-wife, Diana, round to Fry's for tea. Fry even did a stretch in prison, though his incarceration came before the start of his glittering career. As a teenager, he was arrested for going on a weeks-long spree with credit cards that he had lifted from the pockets of friends and strangers. He spent 3 months behind bars. Like Wilde, he was told by an inmate that, "These places aren't for the likes of you." I thought I deserved prison, if anything, more than he did. Fry wrote in his best-selling memoir, Moab is My Washpot, from 1997. The title is borrowed from P.G. Wodehouse, who in turn borrowed it from the King James Bible. The phrase indicates contempt for a lowly place. For many years, Fry lived a life as double as that of Wilde in his prime. By day, Fry was a beloved and omnipresent public figure. By night, and sometimes also by day, he was a heavy drinker and a fiendish cokehead. In a more recent memoir, More Fool Me, published in 2014, Fry offers a list of 50-odd institutions in which he has consumed cocaine, including the BBC's television headquarters, the London Hotel Claridge's, the House of Lords, and Buckingham Palace. His substance habit, shared by Wilde, who preferred absinthe, was an open secret in London's Demimonde, and although Fry was hardly alone in his consumption of illegal drugs, a ruinous public exposure was only one of the dangers he courted. Friends, including John Cleese and Emma Thompson, staged fruitless interventions to curb his use, which lasted for the better part of 15 years. In an email, Thompson told me, one of the most frightening things I ever felt I had to do was intervene by sitting him down and telling him how worried I and most of his friends were by an addiction we were sure would end up killing him. Fry gave up cocaine and cigarettes near his 50th birthday. It's just not really elegant when you're older, he told me. And I probably sensed it would be worse for me, wear away the heart more, or whatever it does. He gave up celibacy, too. For the past decade, Fry has been contentedly married to Elliot Spencer, a comedy writer. I never thought I would be married, and then there you are, he said. He's very grounding, terrible word. Not long ago, Spencer, who was considerably younger, introduced Fry to the work of Kendrick Lamar, whom Fry has praised as a poetical spirit. Thompson, one of Fry's best friends since they were undergraduates at Cambridge University, told me that she and Fry have long shared a great love of Wilde, in particular, his deep humanity, and his awful suffering at the hands of polite society. What more degraded and vicious stratum has there ever been? She added, I am sure that somewhere along the line there is shared DNA between my beloved friend and that brilliant, hugely compassionate, poetic, and conflicted soul. Fry is not vain enough or oblivious enough to push his kinship with Wilde too far himself. I don't have a tenth of his intellectual brilliance. He was a remarkable man, Fry told me one afternoon, when I met him in his dressing room at the Noel Coward Theater, where Ernest is running. But I admire what he admired. I'm not a conscious imitator, but one unconsciously picks up some of the rhythms of his speech. Some of the periods is the old-fashioned word for it, the tropes, as we would now say, the way he balanced a sentence. That's deep in me. I suppose it's bound to be the same way that Walter Pater's language was in him and Samuel Johnson's. Fry had kept Wilde's way of living in mind, he said, during his own wilder years. When I was in my 20s and 30s, I was seduced not so much by brothels or gay sex or anything like that, but by drink and partying and the good life and staying up late and chatting. I kind of bore him in mind when I had to get up the next day and work, and I remembered that he was able to do that, right up until after prison. On Fry's dressing room door, I noticed a sign reading, capital C, period, 3, period, 3, period, the number of Wilde's cell in Reading Gaol. It was a reminder, he said, of what Wilde had been forced to suffer so soon after the effervescent success of Ernest. I'm 22 years older than he was when he died, a hell of a thought, Fry told me. And yet to me, he'll always be my older advisor, my older brother at least. Fry, who grew up with a real older brother, Roger, as well as a younger sister, Joe, discovered Wilde when he was about 12 years old on a rainy day at the family home, a rambling pile in the Norfolk countryside where his father, a physicist, worked on inventions in one of the outbuildings. There was one television, usually in a cupboard, and it would come out for Churchill's funeral, or the man landing on the moon, or a royal wedding, or something, Fry said. One day he turned on a random film. I didn't know what it was. I could see that it was period, but it wasn't Shakespeare, and it wasn't bonnets and Jane Austen, he recalled. The language sort of caught me. There was one moment when a young man kneels in front of the beautiful young girl and says, I hope I will not offend you if I state quite openly and frankly that you seem to me to be in every way the visible personification of absolute perfection. It was like being sandbagged. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Fry ran to his mother and burbled the line out to her. She informed him that the film was called The Importance of Being Earnest. Nowadays, Fry can perform an analysis of that declaration, which Algernon makes to Cecily, with the concision of the literature professor he once thought he might become. The phrase, I love you, he explained, is Anglo-Saxon, the language of the heart to us Britons. We trust Anglo-Saxon, whereas anything Latinate is everything we've always distrusted. To say you are the visible personification of absolute perfection is using a language that doesn't belong to the language of love. It's wrong, so it's funny. It's a category mistake, but it's also a perfect present, a gift. You have wrapped up your love. You've stopped yourself saying, I love you, which anyone can say, and you've presented it in this beautiful parcel of rhythmic utterance. And yet it is artifice, and that is the meaning of the play. That artifice is truer than non-artifice. The young Fry borrowed from the library everything that he could by Wilde. He also found a volume by H. Montgomery Hyde, The Trials of Oscar Wilde. I thought, well, maybe he had trials and tribulations, a difficult life. That's all I could imagine, Fry said. I took it home, and as I read, I felt a mixture of horror, fear, exultation, excitement, all those things at once. Because as the story developed with his arrest and his trials, I recognized that I shared with him what we now call a sexuality, but for which he used the rather wonderful word nature. I shared his nature. So I could simultaneously be thrilled by the fact that someone so great could be like this, could have this, to me, shameful inner secret that I had never even really inspected to myself out loud or in any proper way, but also have the fear that this was a guaranteed ticket to exile, loneliness, shame, disgrace, imprisonment, and all bad things. Wild stylistic magnetism is evident in Fry's own writing. Fry's account in Moab is My Washpot of falling in love for the first time with a newly arrived pupil at his all-boys boarding school is heavily indebted to the conceit in The Importance of Being Earnest that neither Gwendolyn nor Cecily can love a man whose name is not Ernest. But what was his name? Fry writes of the student conjuring the moment after he has just glimpsed him. Suppose his name was somehow wrong. Suppose it was an average name like Richard or Simon or Mark or Robert or Nigel. Fry lacks Wilde's economy. He continues in the same vein for 2 pages and 50-odd names. Fortunately for his husband, Elliot is not among them. While Fry was at boarding school where homosexual activity was not unheard of but an avowed queer identity was out of bounds, reading Wilde gave him a means of understanding his own sexual orientation. Equally important, the writer introduced Fry to the notion of a gay literary pantheon, leading him to discover books by the likes of E.M. Forster and W. Somerset Maugham. "It accidentally gave me an education," Fry told me. "I was reading about writers and reading writers that my contemporaries would never even think of looking at, and all of that sprang from The Importance." As a student, Fry was gifted but troublesome. Useless at sports, he got attention from his peers in other ways, by showing off his cleverness in class, and then by becoming a compulsive shoplifter and thief. At 15, he was expelled after going AWOL in London. Having been granted permission to present a paper at a meeting of the Sherlock Holmes Society, he was, for a time, its youngest member. Fry extended his stay for 4 more days, feasting on A Clockwork Orange and Cabaret at the cinema. His credit card spree occurred around his 18th birthday. "I'm very good at forging signatures, and I went pretty much ape around the country," he told me. In London, he stayed at the Ritz for a night and bought himself a new wardrobe. He was caught only after a desk clerk at a hotel outside the city noticed that his shoes were surprisingly tatty for someone flashing a diner's club card. When he returned to his hotel room one afternoon, 2 police detectives were waiting to arrest him. Fry pleaded guilty to charges of obtaining pecuniary advantage by deception. His prison nickname was the Professor, which he earned for teaching an inmate to read. Most people that are that C-word, but the possession of a nickname puts you a little higher on the ladder than the others, he writes in Moab. After Fry's 3-month sentence was up, he was released on 2 years probation. He returned home and threw himself into the study of English literature. "I got all of Shakespeare down," he said. "I read every single play and wrote a synopsis and my thoughts about it, and read various Shakespearean critics, and I really tried to think about what made literature what it was." Were he a teenager today, he thinks, he would likely be given a diagnosis of ADHD. In English literature, he had found a zone of hyperfocus. "I learned to work and I learned to love it," he said. He took the specialized entrance exam to Cambridge University, to which he was admitted on an academic scholarship. He stood out for more than his height. Kim Harris, a classmate who met Fry at a freshers' sherry party, told me, "I thought he was a junior don with Basil Rathbone in his family tree." Harris, a handsome devotee of Wagner operas, went on to be Fry's roommate and for several years his lover. Fry had already begun his self-creation, Harris recalled. "One of the first conversations I ever had with him at Cambridge was him wondering which of our intake was going to be famous. He was always very interested in fame, and at school that manifested as popularity, but it was the kind of popularity that always held people at a distance. It was a way of hiding in plain sight. He was very conscious about manufacturing a mystique for himself, he would tell me. In More Fool Me, Fry speculates that, had he entered Cambridge 50 years earlier, he might have been tapped as a spy. During that era, he writes, an old-fashioned classical English education was often given to a certain kind of person equipped with charm, intelligence, duplicity, guile, who had an almost pathological need to prove himself to belong. He adds, however, that he thinks it unlikely that the intelligence services would have taken him because of his Jewish heritage. His maternal grandparents were Hungarian Jews, and Fry has been outspoken about anti-Semitism in Britain. In the late 70s, however, another Cambridge tradition called comedy. I'd always had this nagging feeling that I liked trotting about on a stage, Fry said. Emma Thompson told me Stephen could basically extemporize Shakespeare. Fry began appearing in numerous productions, and he even wrote a play, Latin! Exclamation point, which drew on his experiences at preparatory school. I'm sure it would be pretty eye-watering now because it's a satirical comedy about pederastic school teachers, he told me. He was recruited to join the Cambridge Footlights comedy group by then, its president, Hugh Laurie, who had seen Fry in a production of Volpone. In an email, Laurie told me, I was looking to cast a review for the Cambridge Footlights and desperately wanted adult roosters in a field of squeaky, prancy cockerels. Stephen walked on stage and it all fell into place. I remember nothing of the play except this mesmerizing giant who stood at the center. Fry had, Laurie went on, such gravity, such authority. Also an odd melancholy that just grabbed me from the first. By the mid-80s, Fry and Laurie had become fixtures of light entertainment on British television. They appeared in their own sketch show and later in Jeeves and Wooster, an adaptation of P.G. Wodehouse novels, in which Fry plays an omnicompetent butler. Over the years, from the first day to this, Stephen and I have laughed more with each other than anyone else I can think of, Laurie said. Unless he has other secret laughing partners, which is possible, because he keeps secrets, by God he does. In the early 90s, Fry's financial situation received a boost when he helped revise the book of the 1937 British musical Me and My Girl, which went on to a 3-year run on Broadway, with Fry reportedly earning 3% of its box office revenue. But in an interview from this period, Fry explained that he was hopeless with money. If I have a bone, I eat it. I don't bury it in the garden. I can't hoard anything, and that includes thoughts. I spend. Thoughts, money, myself. I can't save and conserve anything. Fry's polymathic talent spilled forth. In 1991, he published the first of 4 novels, The Liar, a semi-autobiographical account of a brilliant and mendacious schoolboy. A bestseller, it includes long fictional extracts from a pornographic manuscript about child prostitution, supposedly written by Charles Dickens. That you should stand exposed as an amuser of children, naught but a corrector of youth, a pedestal. A malapropism, prone housekeeper cries. As Fry's star rose, so did attempts to knock him off his own pedestal. Some were grotesquely literal. Anti-gay insults and fists were thrown at a school reunion dinner at which Fry was the speaker, leading to the levying of fines against Fry's detractors. In a degraded opinion piece, a Daily Mail columnist wrote, why is it that Stephen Fry is so eminently whackable, smackable, kickable, flickable? The answer is that he is simply the most irritating man in the country. The paper even offered a blow-up-and-biff Stephen Fry doll to readers. Jokes about harming celebrities have aged about as well as jokes about pederasty, and perhaps it's not surprising that such threats left Fry in a state of distress. Things reached ahead in 1995 when he co-starred in a new play, Cellmates, in the West End. Three shows into the run, which had received mixed reviews, he disappeared to Belgium. He later faxed a note to his agent explaining that he felt he'd failed as an actor. Fry was missing for several days, and friends feared that he'd taken his own life. Afterward, Fry was given a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. "It was really very powerful," he said. "All kinds of things fell into place, my childhood and my teenage years." The diagnosis offered Fry a way of understanding why he was so different from everyone else, especially his brother, with whom he shared an environment at home and at school. He and Roger, an electrical engineer, are close. Joe has been his personal assistant for decades. Fry told me, "I was more transgressive, always different and troubled and weird, but also driven in a different way, curious and anxious to eat data and to experience things. I always felt I was more alive than other people." Fry's mood disorder requires vigilance. "He is no longer on daily medication," he told me, "but he's ready for it," he explained. "I've got some stuff that takes me down if I get very manic, in case I get one of what I call my Joan of Arc moments, when I get a bit of sort of irradiated and start doing weird things and tidying up the house and making strange arrangements of things and never going to bed." Fry's career recovered from his flight to Belgium. In the decades since, he has appeared in countless documentaries, TV shows, podcasts, and commercials. "I'm just a girl who can't say N-N-N-N," he said as if the last word were stuck in his throat. In the past 3 years, he has cropped up as the King of England in Matthew Lopez's gay rom-com, Red, White, and Royal Blue, as a British scientist on The Dropout, a TV series about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos, and as a ne'er-do-well dad in Lena Dunham's latest show, Too Much. When he's not on screen, he's appearing on panels about AI computer science being another of his passions. Fry, along with Jeffrey Hinton and Steve Wozniak, is a signatory to a recent statement calling for a prohibition on the development of superintelligence until it can be done safely. He has described superintelligence as an unknowable and highly risky goal. Once he was an enthusiastic user of Twitter, but his optimism about social media has waned. "It's like the opening of the canal system, a wonderful method of transport. You can get stuff made in Birmingham and get it to the sea," he said. "Then before you know it, it's full of rusting Tesco trolleys and turds." He has reconsidered his past, including his wayward youth, in the light of his brain chemistry. "If you are subject to mood changes that are not normal, that are greater and more extreme than most people, and you are 15, you don't know there is such a thing as bipolar disorder," he told me. "So you do something to stabilize your mood. Stealing," he went on, "zinged me up." Since 2011, Fry has been the president of Mind, a mental health charity in the UK, and he is an honorary fellow of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. He has been open about the fact that over the years, his struggles with mental illness have led to suicide attempts. Fry said, "Oddly enough, coming out as gay in the 80s, in the period of AIDS, and having the need to speak out and to feel there was a place for you in the public eye. You know, a welder in Huddersfield couldn't come out very easily in the 80s, but I, as an actor, could. That was a template, in a way, for mental health disclosure." He declines to excuse his cocaine addiction as merely a form of self-medication. "There are plenty of people who wrestle with their mental illness and don't immediately go and buy drugs," he noted. All the same, if Wilde died too early to see a time in which his same-sex desire would be understood as an essential part of his individual makeup rather than as a criminal failing, Fry has lived long enough to see a time in which it is more readily understood that a mood disorder is not a character flaw, but an element of an individual's nature. Indeed, he helped usher that time in, an instance of what Richard Ellman, describing Wilde's approach to politics, characterized as associating art with social change and replacing a morality of severity with one of sympathy. One mustn't go too far in the direction of St. Oscar, Fry warned me one afternoon in his dressing room. He was a flawed man. Of course he was. It could be argued, Fry said, that Wilde was a fool not to flee to France before being indicted for gross indecency. Moreover, Fry continued, we can look at it as brave, but he didn't exactly stand and defend homosexuality outright. He pleaded not guilty. Various critics, Fry noted, have condemned Wilde for using sex workers and otherwise exploiting people of a lower class. That's okay, there are going to be lots of different views of Oscar, he said. He certainly saw boys who we would consider underage now, I think 15. We can bring our own morality to it if you want to and curse him forever. Fry sees a paradox in this. Wilde taught us, above all writers and thinkers of his time, to be very wary of such arrogance and stupidity as to believe that our morality is anything other than custom. What pains Fry the most about Wilde's final years is that, apart from the prison poem, The Ballad of Reading Goal, which Wilde wrote upon his release, he finished nothing else of note, instead spending what remained of his short life in dissipation. His power seemed to have drained away, Fry said. Once again, though, he found an alternative way to frame this behavior. Wilde said himself, I put all my talents into my work, I put my genius into my life, which again sounds like one of those clever little Oscar remarks, but to some extent, he did throw an enormous amount into the way he lived and the way he dressed and the way he spoke. Fry took out his phone and read aloud a quotation on Wilde, this one from Jean Cocteau. Oscar Wilde paid dearly for being Oscar Wilde, but it was the height of privilege to be Oscar Wilde. It's natural that it cost dearly. Kim Harris, Fry's old friend from Cambridge, became a screenwriter. He told me that one important way in which Fry differs from Wilde is that, whereas Wilde sought to be a true artist, Fry regards himself as an entertainer. Artists say, take it or leave it, this is what I have to say. And Stephen's never done that, Harris told me. He hates people not liking him. He would rather be unpretentious and unarrogant about what he does. He admires artists, he stands in awe of them, but he could never have that colossal, arrogant indifference that some artists need. Fry affirmed Harris's appraisal. I care about seeing the look in someone's eyes when I talk or perform, and hearing the applause, he said, it vindicates me. It's a weakness. As a vehicle for the expression of Wilde's artistry, however, Fry has few rivals. Although the audiences filling the Noel Coward Theater for Ernest may be lured by Fry's celebrity, every night there is applause at his first entrance as he sweeps on stage in a vast yardage of purple and black satin, with a large black hat perched on a steely wig of curls, which together lend even more inches to his already imposing height. They stay for Wilde's wit and for Fry's powers in embodying it. As the performance goes on, it becomes clear that what is transpiring on stage is not a star turn, but the unfolding truth about a woman called Lady Bracknell, a woman anxious about money, consumed with propriety, and utterly threatened by the confounding desires and demands of a younger generation that will soon eclipse her. In a fit-for TikTok flourish, the conventional curtain call has been replaced by the cast members taking turns dancing, each one extravagantly costumed as a flower in honor of Wilde, who sometimes wore on his lapel a green carnation, a covert symbol of his homosexuality. When I sat in on the rehearsal, this was the one section that Fry had not wanted me to observe, so self-conscious is he about the way he dances. Though he dominates the play with his linguistic fluency, the joyful physical ease of his younger cast members underlines Fry's awkwardness as he shimmies downstage every night in a pair of multicolored bloomers and a ruffled blouse, haloed by the petals of an enormous red poppy. After the play opened, Fry told me, I've never been a dancer, I just kind of go, oh my God. The other night, the movement director came in and watched, and she told me afterward, I think it's so cute the way I can see you go 5, 6, 7, 8. Once the play opened, I attended a performance and witnessed the excruciating dance. When it was over, Fry stepped forward to make an announcement. "This is a very special day," he declared. "It's a special day because you're in the audience." There was a ripple of laughter at the ingratiation. "But it's an even more special day because it is the 16th of October, which is the birthday of our author, Oscar Wilde." There were gasps, then applause and cheers. "He was born 171 years ago in Ireland," Fry went on. "And he died at the age of 46, just 6 years after his greatest triumph, this play." A few weeks after the magnificently successful opening, a series of court cases cascaded him into the greatest scandal of his age, and he died in poverty and misery and pain. Silence had fallen over the house. Fry then shifted tone, calling on the audience to join him in the singing of Happy Birthday. He stood in his bloomers and ruffles, his feet planted stoutly apart, conducting the crowd with vigor. Then he lifted his right hand in a flourish, casting his eyes upward as he sang the words, "Dear Oscar." Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Dale with The New Yorker.
Thanks for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to Lab Radio. Request a free specialized receiver, or for more information about our radio reading service, call Lab at 978-454-5704. You can listen to Lab Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Or visit our website where you can tune into Lab Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. Thanks for listening.